And now, it's your turn with Dave Mullarkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's your turn on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn, 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Mullarkey.
Well, good afternoon once again, everyone. Nice to have you with us on the Monday edition of It's Your Turn. After a weekend that felt a lot like summer, huh? Especially after the rain ended Saturday morning, and it got nice, and then yesterday, 85 degrees was the high yesterday here in Butler, and it was hot from the get-go. I came out of church about 11 o'clock. It was already 80 degrees yesterday. Hey, it's a book talk day today. Now, we're a little early, but that often happens in May. In fact, it usually happens in May because of Memorial Day always falling on a Monday. So next week we won't have a program. So we decided to move Book Talk up a week, and I'm happy that we did. Laurie Hinterleiter is here. She's the executive director of the Butler Area Public Library. Laurie, good to see you as always.
Yes, it's great to be back, and it's a beautiful day out there right now. So
It's nice.
Great time to talk about a book that may be a good summer read, right?
I agree. Yes, the book that you've chosen for us to discuss this month is Where the Crawdads Sing by Delia Owens. I was saying Delia.
I don't know.
It's an unusual name.
It is. I keep wanting to say Delilah, but it's not that. I'm not sure how she pronounces it.
And I've not seen her interviewed anywhere, although I'm sure she has been, because this book has skyrocketed. It's on the New York Times bestseller list for months now. Months and months.
Months and months and months. And just in our local library system, you would be hard-pressed. I was hard-pressed. I actually didn't get a print copy to read. I tried to reserve a copy on our Overdrive electronic source. It was an 8-month wait.
8-month wait?
Yes, and I knew that wasn't going to work, and this was 3 or 4 months ago. And so I actually had to buy my own ebook copy so that I was ready to talk about this with you today.
My copy comes from the Cranberry Public Library. I don't know how
I managed
to get
it. I think it might have been hijacked. I'm just not going to announce, let anybody know.
Well, anyway, it was just published. It was a little less than a year ago. I think it was sometime last summer.
I want to say about a year, maybe.
The author is a graduate. She has a zoology degree, a study of animals. She's written a number of books, nonfiction. She and her husband spent, I don't know, 7 or 8 years in Africa studying animals there. So she's an accomplished scientist and nature writer. But this was her first novel.
I know. I was fascinated when I read that, because if you read more about her background, like you said, she's a highly acclaimed nonfiction writer of very scientific types of material. And so when I read that this was her first fiction attempt, I was very impressed.
Well, it's a pretty good story, and she has a wonderful way with words. I marked a few quotes. Maybe we'll get to pass them on to listeners as we discuss the book, but I thought she wrote wonderfully. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about this, how to categorize this book. I saw one review that said it's part coming-of-age novel, it's part mystery, it's part murder mystery, it's part courtroom drama. It's all of that, isn't
it? I was going to say, I think that basically covers it all, and it is a little bit of each of those topics.
I have to tell you straight away, I enjoy the book immensely.
Yes, I hoped you would. I'm always a little skeptical when there's so much hype about a book. We see that a lot at the library, and then there's a big letdown because either somebody famous has just promoted it for whatever reason, and then it's just not the quality that you expect. But when I read it, I was happily.
Well, this apparently took off when Reese Witherspoon, of all people, selected it for her book club. I have to be honest with you, Laurie, I didn't even know that Reese Witherspoon had a book club.
I know. Obviously, probably everybody's aware that Oprah Winfrey, she was probably the first celebrity of that caliber to have a book club, and so everything was always talked about. But since then, there have been a few other celebrities, including Sarah Jessica Parker, who has worked with the American Library Association. And I am going to say that Reese probably started her book picks, her book club, a year or two ago. It hasn't been that long. So I think she's had a lot of followers just because of her acting experience and her age and different things. She has a big fan base. So,
well, we have a variety of ages there. Mm-hmm. Oprah would be the senior.
Yes.
Sarah Jessica Parker is kind of middle age, and then Reese Witherspoon is much younger. But they all, I guess Oprah still has a book club. I don't know. She doesn't have a TV show anymore, to the best of my knowledge.
I'm sure she probably suggests book titles all the time.
Well, my edition, since you don't have one, I have to show you mine. has right on the cover there, Reese's Book Club. Mm-hmm. So when she selected it, apparently really took off. And I had not heard of the book, quite frankly, until my copy came and I started to read it. But as I read more about it, read some reviews, it's just been the talk of the town here for the better part of the last year. Book clubs all over America are reading
it. Hubbub. Just talk everywhere. Everyone who comes in the library, have you read it? You should read it. How can I get a copy of it? I mean, it's just been one of those phenomena you don't see very often.
Well,
especially for so long.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Staying power.
Yes.
The main character is, I wasn't quite sure how to pronounce her name. I ended up going with Kia, like the car company, the auto company. It's spelled K-Y-A.
I don't know, because as we were talking earlier, when they reveal her full proper name, Catherine, I forget what her middle name is.
Catherine Danielle Clark.
I'm not sure how Kia, Kaya, whatever it may be, actually evolves from that. But
well, I debated when I started to read, and then I decided I was going to go with Kia. And, of course, once you get that burned into your brain, then that's,
I think it works.
As I read along, that's what I said. By the way, there's time jumping here.
Yes.
The device, the structure of the book goes from the early 1950s all the way up to the 1970s. And it starts out, I think it's 1952, and then it jumps to 69, and then it goes back to 56, and it jumps back to the late 60s, and it goes back to 1960. So eventually they merge.
Correct.
By the time you get to the end of the book, the two timelines. But this sounds like it might be confusing. I did not think so.
No, I didn't think it was cumbersome. Sometimes I feel when you read a book like that and that style, you almost need to take notes because it gets confusing. But I didn't find that with
this. No, sometimes you can't figure out where you're at.
Right.
For one thing, the chapter titles give you the date. You know, and they say, okay, now we're in 1956. So, and it's easy to follow Kia because, by the way, this takes place in the marshland, coastal North Carolina.
The Carolinas, which is a different setting than a lot of historical fiction books. I haven't read too many about the marshland, so that was interesting.
She starts out, Delia Owens, by describing the difference between a marsh and a swamp, which I had not delineated in my own mind before.
I have to be honest that I had not either. I actually learned quite a bit as far as the actual scientific part of the book that she shared about the marshlands and about the habitat and the different wildlife that lived there.
To put this in a nutshell, and we'll talk about it in a little bit more detail, but this Kia Clark, who is 6 years old in 1952 when the novel starts, it follows her as she grows up for much of the time by herself, living in the swamp.
In very rudimentary conditions.
Yes. She lived in a shack and became known as the marsh girl, the swamp girl. And as I was reading it, at least initially, there was a little bit of Robinson Crusoe in here.
Yes, I actually thought part of it when they were describing some of her adventures, how fun it would be to be a kid and actually go on some of her adventures in the marsh and become, I'll say, friends with some of the wildlife.
And she talked with the seagulls a lot, which kind of reminded me of Robinson Crusoe, who, you know, had these imaginary conversations before Friday, before he had his man Friday.
Yes.
Boy, it's been a long time since I read Robinson Crusoe.
You have to go back and reread.
I think we actually did that on Book Talk here some time ago, as I recall. But anyway, that's another story, another day. I had a little bit of trouble suspending my disbelief that a girl this young could live on her own and survive in the swamp. Was that a problem for you?
At the beginning, when she was only 6 years old.
Yeah.
And that out of necessity, she became so self-reliant. Although she's very intelligent, I found it really hard to believe for a while that she would be able to accommodate and basically teach herself anything, protection from the elements, food. I mean, food was a huge issue at first for her. All of those things, and just protection and, staying out of harm's way. Yes, everything.
How did she get to be living on her own? Talk about that.
Well, she had originally, she came from a fairly large family. She lived with several brothers and sisters and her father and mother in this, I'll say, cabin. I don't even know what to say.
They referred to it as a shack.
Yes. Very sparse living quarters. And there was a lot of troubles. Her father was a veteran and disabled and had some mental health issues.
World War II veteran and very abusive.
Yes, very.
He drank and he gambled.
Yes.
And he beat the family members up. He beat up the kids. He beat up his wife.
All of them. Yeah. And so at one point, some of the children left, but Mom one day just packed up in her best outfit, walked down the lane, and they never saw her again. And from that time on, the older siblings eventually left as well for their own protection and for survival. Mm-hmm. And they left her there with her dad.
I realize that, this is fiction, and, the author, Delia Owens, is setting up the plot, but my first thought was, if a wife is going to leave an abusive husband who beats her, and she has a six-year-old daughter, she's going to take the six-year-old with her. The older kids, okay, they can get on, because the next youngest was like 7 years older and already a teenager.
Yes.
But she's going to take the six-year-old girl, don't you think?
I would have hoped so, and that was disturbing. And you just kept hoping at the beginning first few chapters that she would come back and or somebody would come and fetch her or something, which didn't happen. And so then eventually farther along in the story, then her father, who would come in and out, he would disappear for long periods of time, but he eventually never returned, and so she was completely by herself.
By that time, I think she was 10.
Yes.
But that's still, you look at a 10-year-old and you think,
it's just amazing.
Living by themselves in a swamp. And I find that a little hard to believe. But one of the big themes in this book, at least as I saw it, was loneliness.
Yes.
So that's what she was trying to set up.
Isolation, loneliness.
Yeah.
And then opportunities down the road that may have given her a chance to be more social or be with people throughout the many, many years that she was isolated, that really made it hard for her to be able to adapt.
And there were some sad things here. She had never gone to school. She was, I believe, 7 or 8, somewhere in that range. And the truant officers came to the shack. By the way, they called it a shack. It had a porch because she slept on the porch.
Yes.
But at any rate, they came and they said, you got to go to school. It's mandatory. And even though this was a pretty tiny village, and the marshes of the Carolina coast, they did have a school. So she went for one day.
And that part, she never returned, basically, because of all the kids who bullied her and made fun of her, mm-hmm. which, you know, we hear so much about today. So there were a lot of themes, I think, within this story that people can relate to today.
They put her in a second grade class, even though she'd never been in school before. She didn't have any shoes. The kids made fun of her, mm-hmm. and she just never went back. That was it, one day. So she was illiterate, which adds, at least for me, to the difficulty in swallowing the fact that she was able to live by herself as a kid whenever she...
For so many years.
She couldn't read or write. She could only count to 29, as I recall. Mm-hmm. It was very strange. But, you know, imagine the loneliness, imagine the isolation, you know, and kept longing for her mother to come back.
Yes.
She, and this is where the author Delia Owens kind of starts to weave in so much of her nature description. The way that this girl, little girl to start with, and eventually a teenager, the way she learned about life since she couldn't read was watching nature.
Yes.
Watching birds, watching the animals in the marsh and in the swamp. And she always thought that if a child had been abandoned, the mother came back.
Yes.
You know, and she would watch birds or other animals. And so that made her that made her think that her mother was going to come back sometime. And, of course, she never did.
No. Mm-hmm. Yes. It was sad, but also just amazing how the author did incorporate that side of nature and what she learned.
Let me give you one quote before we take a break here. And this is early in the book, actually, but it gives you an idea of the writing style of Delia Owens, which I thought was really splendid. This is where she's talking about the difference between a marsh
and
a swamp. And I'll read just a few sentences here. Marsh is not swamp. Marsh is a space of light where grass grows in water and water flows into the sky. Swamp water is still and dark, having swallowed the light in its muddy throat. What a turn of a phrase that is.
Yes.
Swamp water is still and dark, having swallowed the light in its muddy throat. That's pretty good stuff. Yeah. We'll take a break. It's a book talk today. We do this every month, by the way, the last Monday of the month, except in May when we had to move it up because of Memorial Day. We'll pick up our conversation with Laurie Hinderleiter here on It's Your Turn on WISR in just a moment. One of our sponsors on the program today is Schnoor's Greenhouse. Schnoor's, do you have your flowers and plants yet? You know, even the late stuff, the vegetable plants, you know, most folks put them in by Memorial Day, sometimes on Memorial Day weekend. They've got a tremendous selection of vegetable plants at Schnoor's Greenhouse, family-owned and operated since 1889. That's not 1989, that's 1889. Yes, they're celebrating 130 years of business. Very knowledgeable staff, obviously, very friendly service. And they've got annuals and beautiful hanging baskets, too, in addition to the vegetable plants. Really a tremendous selection from which to choose. Where is Schnoor's Greenhouse? If you've not been there before, it's off Herman Road. Look for Schnoor Road by the RC Men's Club. It's easy to find. Butler's longtime trusted greenhouse. That's Schnoor's Greenhouse. They're open Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Saturday 8 to 5. Sunday 11 to 5. Schnoor's Greenhouse. Since 1889, it's been the place to grow. The Young Funeral Home of Butler invites you to stop by their Jefferson Street location, downtown Butler, to talk about pre-arrangements. Not the easiest thing to do, but necessary. And the Young family will walk you through the process, making it very comfortable and really easy to take care of. You'll experience peace of mind knowing that your wishes and plans will be carried out to the last detail. Call the Young Funeral Home in Butler today to make an appointment with a member of the Young family. Generations of the Young family have been caring for generations of Butler families for well over 40 years. The Young Funeral Home, West Jefferson Street in Butler. Talking about the Delia Owens novel, runaway bestseller. It's been creating buzz all over the country for several months. Where the Crawdads Sing is the name of it. By the way, a crawdad is, I had to look it up. It's the same as a crayfish.
Yes, not the prettiest of animal creatures.
Pretty ugly, as a matter of fact. Well, anyway, I guess they got tons of them down in North Carolina. Well, anywhere along the coast, you'll find them. And I guess they sing like cicadas, maybe, huh?
I guess we were just talking about cicadas. They'll be here before you know it if they haven't already arrived.
I could find myself in the marsh, in the swamp, when I was reading passages of this book. It was, you know, you were really transported there.
I was going to say, her descriptive writing method just really did put you right there.
Mm-hmm.
You could imagine all the sounds that you could hear, or just, I was just thinking when she, even on the porch, like all of the different bugs and things crawling on you. And
well, it did make me hungry for crawfish or crawdads, but I was transported via her writing. You mentioned the other kids in the family. There was the closest sibling to little Kia was Jody, a brother, who was 7 years older, so he's already 13 at the very beginning of the book, whenever she's only six. And then there was another brother, Murphy, and then there were two older sisters, Missy and Mandy, but they were all much older.
Much older, and so they all left Kia. Either they were old enough to leave, or Jody left for his own safety. And like you said, he was a teenager, so he left.
Now, almost instantly at the beginning of this book, whenever Delia Owens kind of sets the stage for this little girl in the abusive family, suddenly we cut to 1969, and a body, a dead body, is found at the foot of a fire tower.
Yes, the body of Chase, was it Anderson? I can't remember his last name.
Andrews,
yes, okay. And Chase was the classic small-town star athlete. His family was very well-known. They owned a business. You know, he was the hero in some respects of that area. And there his body was found at the bottom of this tower.
Mm-hmm. I instantly thought of Cook Forest. Have you ever gone to Cook Forest and the fire tower?
Yes, I thought about that too.
It's the only one around here that I know of. They have them out west a lot, the fire towers.
It was exactly, that's what I thought of as well. And part of the mystery was how, you know, he ended up at the bottom of the fire tower.
Mm-hmm. And they had one terminology that I've actually not seen it used in a fire tower, but he called it the switchback, and referring to the stairs, because that's how, you know, you go up for 10 steps,
and then
you immediately turn and go the other direction, up another 10, and then you do it again. There's not really landings. It's just, well, it's a switchback. That's how you get to the top of the fire tower. I can remember climbing up to the top of that one at Cook Forest when I was a kid.
Oh, yes?
I probably not any more than 7 or 8 years old, and it felt like you were on the top of the world when you were up there.
Yes, yes. I know, I thought about that, too, and then they were talking about, like, trap doors or, you know, the gates or whatever. So, yes.
You could never get in the trap door at the top of the one at Cook Forest. It was always locked. But once you got up to the very top, you could, you know, see all around there, Seneca Point and all those places. I didn't realize they had them in the marshlands of North Carolina, but makes for the nice murder plot.
Yes.
Well, murder or accident?
That was the question.
They don't know. You know, maybe he climbed up there and maybe he was drunk and he fell down or something, you know.
There were very little clues, if any.
Couple of boys who were out riding bikes and spotted the body, and they called in the sheriff and his deputy.
Yes, they reminded me a little bit of Andy Griffith.
It's the same with me and Don Knotts.
Yeah. It seems to be a very small department, let's put it that way.
Let's talk a little bit about this Chase Andrews person. Not a very likable guy. Okay, he's a star quarterback, yada, 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 but he was a real Lothario. He was a real ladies' man.
Yeah.
And, you know, even after he was married, he was running around with other women. And
even before that, earlier in the story, if you go back to the 1950s flashback, one of the incidents was Keo was in town or nearby, and some of his friends, they were all out, and they were quite obnoxious, and he was definitely not one of those.
Not a very likable character, which is one of the reasons why the sheriff and the deputy thought that he might have been murdered. Apparently, it was common knowledge that he was running around with the wife of some other guy, and
it seemed
they thought this guy might have killed him.
You know? It seemed very well known that there could have been several motives for his murder.
And they just tantalize you with that, and then instantly it cuts back to the 1950s. And, you know, what's happening with Kia. She, for a brief period, her father kind of warms up to her.
Yes.
This is after all the other kids have gone, the mother's gone, there's just the father and little
kids
Kia.
Kids stop drinking for a short period of time.
And he takes her fishing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he has a boat with a small outboard motor.
And I would say maybe not taught her a lot of life skills, but maybe gave her a few things that she could take with her in the future.
Well, by being able to go out on the boat, she learned how to use it, how to start it, that it needed
navigating,
gas. Every
navigating the canals, or what, I don't know what they call those, but in the marsh.
Channels, I guess.
Channels,
I don't know. Very complicated. Everything looked the same. It was easy to get lost. In fact, after she has been out fishing for a while, then she occasionally will sneak the boat out by herself whenever her father is off on one of his drunken binges. And she gets lost in these, circuitous channels, and is only saved because of?
Because of Tate, who happened to be, and we didn't know this at first, but happened to be a friend of Jody, her older brother.
Mm-hmm.
And so she really didn't remember him, but Tate remembered her.
And he's like, what, 4 or 5 years older?
I was going to say a little younger than Jody, but several years older than Kia. And so he just happens, our luck, I guess, to be out in the same area and noticed her and guided her home.
Yeah, because otherwise she would have never made it back to her shack. And he takes her back, but that's the end of that, you know. Okay, thanks very much. See you later. She, of course, as lonely as she is, she has no friends. She only went to school for one day. Everybody else in her family is gone, and she's yearning for a friend, somebody to talk to.
And I also thought it was interesting because there were other people who lived in the marshes. It wasn't that that was the only shack, but she doesn't interact with anyone else, even though it might have been a distance away. But there was no interaction even with other marsh people.
There's a touch of the racial divide at that time. Now, keep in mind, we're talking about the 1950s here, and we're in the Deep South in Carolina. On the outskirts of the marsh, on the other side of the village, there's a place which referred to, as the language did back in those days, colored town.
Yes.
By the way, there's a map in the book, which I found most helpful. You can see where the shack was, the marsh, the fire tower, colored town, the village,
and yes, exactly.
All that stuff. So you could follow, where she was going. And I guess that's why the author set her up to learn how to run the boat, so that she could get out a little bit. Otherwise, she would have been in the same place the whole time,
Exactly.
She did strike up a friendship with an African-American man who had one of those gas stations on a pier, where you could fill up for your boat motor, who went by the name of Jumpin.
Yes, Jumpin, who became a very good friend of hers. Mm-hmm. Almost like a father figure,
I agree.
I think.
Yeah, I agree. Mm-hmm. And she, by the way, her father, we're talking about the abusive father, I think his name was Mike. No, Jake. They only mentioned him a couple of times, his name. But he, because he had been wounded in World War II, he got a disability pension. And that's really all they had to live on.
Yes, and she relied when he was around for what little money he had left or would give to her. And often it was very, very little to buy groceries or food when she was able to navigate to Jumpin's or in town.
But once he took off, there was no more disability pension, no money. So what did she do?
Well, she was very creative. I mean, she was very smart. I don't want to say street smart, but how about marsh smart?
Good.
And she started then digging, was it for mussels or clams? What was that?
Mussels.
Mm-hmm. So she started digging for those and then would take them to Jumpin's to have him purchase, and then he would sell them. I always feel like it was the mini mart of the day, you know, along the with the gas station.
That's true, because she had been sent to the grocery store. By the way, if you've never been to the South, the most common grocery store down there, you know, it's like the Giant Eagle of the South, is Piggly Wiggly.
Yes.
And she never mentioned that it was a grocery store. She, you know, says, "Well, and that's where the Piggly Wiggly was." I knew it was a grocery store. I'm afraid some people wouldn't. But the clerks made fun of her in there.
Yes.
So she, when she found out that the Jumpin's place where she could get gas, you're right, it was kind of sheets. So,
of the day, yeah. Right? So she was able to make do. She went to the village grocery store sometimes and had a somewhat of a relationship with the one clerk. But when she found out that she could make do with what Jumpin had, mm-hmm. And that's really what happened.
Mainly grits. That's what they ate.
Grits, and then she, after she mastered that, and then she would kind of try to add a few other things to that. Before she sold the mussels, though, remember she tried to smoke fish, and it must not have been so successful.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that.
And I think Jumpin got her onto the mussel, selling the mussels.
That's when he went to home to his wife.
Yes.
Whose name was?
I can't.
Mabel or Myrtle, one of the two.
It might have been Mabel, I think.
But he said, "Hey, look, there's this little girl. She's like 10 years old, and I think she might be living by herself, and we know something we can do." He says, "Look, she gave me these fish," and Mabel said, these are horrible. Nobody's going to buy these." So she went to her church.
Yes.
And the women of the church put together some clothes and some shoes because Kia had nothing.
And they made up a fictitious story that if she brought these mussels, that people would buy them and exchange for some of these items. Well, there really wasn't anyone, but she didn't know that for a long time, that they were just helping her out.
Kind of took care of her. Well, as you said, almost like a stepdad.
Yes.
was Jumpin. So life goes on. She gets to be a little bit older. We keep jumping back to the late 60s and the investigation of the death of Chase Adams. You know, we go through the part where the sheriff has to tell his parents who own the Western Auto.
Yes.
I found it unbelievable that a little dinky village of this size could have a Western Auto store, but they did.
Yes. And we should probably mention that Kia's father, her mother and father, came from prominent families, and that her father's family at one time had a plantation and were quite wealthy, and then lost that during the Depression, I think.
Mm-hmm. Let me give you another quote, because I marked this. The father spoke in a pretty heavy dialect, and every once in a while, a little bit difficult to understand. Not all that bad, but I marked another quote here. Let me see if I can find it, because it refers to what you were talking about. And this is one of the few times that the abusive dad actually talked to his daughter, Kia. And my dialect's probably not too good. He said, "My folks weren't always po', you know. They had land, rich land, raised tobacco and cotton and such, over near Asheville. Your grandma on my side wore bonnets big as wagon wheels and long skirts. We lived in a house with a veranda that went all the way around. It was fine, mighty fine." You're right. They were pretty rich.
They were. So that was another just piece of the story, because everyone was so judgmental of the Marsh girl, not even in the family, and not even realizing that at one point they were all on equal terms.
There were times as she grew older and got into her mid-teens that remember a bunch of kids came out one time with the torches and banged on the door of the shack and made a lot of noise and then ran away, you know, making fun of her, scared her to death. But that happens. That happens in a lot of towns today where, you know, there's somebody
there's
who lives off by themselves and, you know, the teenagers.
A lot of things that you can relate to. Is things still happening today?
Yeah.
The same types of things.
Yeah. So what happens with the Tate guy? And I had a last name for him in my notes somewhere. Walker. Tate Walker. This is the boy that she spotted fishing one day when she got lost in her boat, and he led her back out of the marsh.
And Tate's father is a fisherman and has some type of business. But Tate spent a lot of his time in the marsh because his desire for his future plans were to study zoology or marine biology. So he spent a lot of time. So at one occasion, there was another, I'll say, chance meeting. And it ended up, after a long story, that Tate started to teach Kaya how to read and did that for a long time. And although they didn't have, I'll say, readers or, you know, the proper books to start someone on how to read, he would bring all these scientific publications. And so began some of her studies.
I must say, I rolled my eyeballs a little bit at this part.
I thought it was a stretch.
You know, she's 14 and he's 18 and he's teaching her how to read. And I don't know.
It was a stretch. And especially how they described how this was, you know, done and what he would bring to her.
Now, she had accumulated, by happenstance, a lot of knowledge of nature. She collected shells. She collected feathers, which, as I recall now, is how they would... He kind of signaled his interest in her. He left some feathers on a tree stump where she found them, and then she would take another feather back, and it was like this.
It was almost like one-upmanship, too, as far as the feathers. You know, one was more... a little more important or more significant or a little more, frilly or something than the other.
Some rare feather from a blue heron or something like that. But I thought it was neat because it was kind of an analogy of the mating courtship of birds.
Yes.
You know, when the male and the female birds go back and forth, and that's kind of what they were doing, you know. As teenagers.
Yes, correct. There was a lot of analogies with nature in the book that was very interesting. I loved, you know, her writing style and how she did incorporate some of these things into the story.
So what happened? The romance really never blossomed, though, did it?
No. He was torn. You know, he was madly in love with her. She really wasn't at that. I mean, she was fascinated and infatuated, I think, but mostly just because it was an actual person that she had contact with.
I agree. It was somebody to talk to. You know, yes. She had nobody.
But eventually, he went off to college, and, you know, he had promised at that time he would come back for her, and he had, you know, proclaimed his love for her. But as often happens when you go off to college, things change. You get, you know, diverted by other interests, and other young ladies, whatever.
And he was indeed intent on becoming a scientist.
Yes,
you know.
Very, very serious about that.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about, if you joined us a little bit late on the program today, we're talking about Where the Crawdads Sing. It's a runaway bestseller and has been for months and months and months by Delia Owens, and it's our selection. Well, actually, it was Laurie's selection for Book Talk this month. Laurie Hinderlander is the executive director of the Butler Area Public Library. I would say if you're interested, pick up a copy at your local library, but it's going to be hard to find.
It's going to be a little while before you get the copy.
Yeah,
we've been adding copies, you know, but it's just that popular right now.
Mm-hmm. Very, very popular. Very popular among book clubs, too. Mm-hmm. There are book clubs at Butler Area Public Library, right?
There are. We actually have two that meet at the library, but we have several book clubs in the community that use our book club kits, which basically you receive a bag that has 12 copies of the book. We just got one for this particular book.
Mm-hmm.
And then people can check it out, have their discussion wherever they meet.
And then bring the whole bag of books back.
Bring the whole bag book and pick another one.
Yeah, and I know people that do that, too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We'll talk more about Where the Crawdads Sing here on WISR in just a moment. One of our sponsors on the program today is Gone Postal Butler, your friendly neighborhood shipping center. Just off Newcastle Road, what do? They package your items for shipping. Very convenient. You don't have to run around hunting for the right size box or the bubble wrap or the special tape or the mailing label. They do it all for you. You can still ship it any way you want, U.S. Postal Service or FedEx or UPS, but they'll package it up. Pretty neat, huh? They're located in the Shockey Mini Storage Complex right behind King's and Villa Grande restaurants on Newcastle Road. Gone Postal Butler. They have other services, too, copying, scanning, faxing, mailbox rentals, even an official notary. They're open Monday through Friday. Your friendly neighborhood shipping center. Going Postal Butler in the Shockey Mini Storage Complex. We'll be right back.
Planning ahead is simple. Planning at the last minute is hard and emotionally frustrating. And planning a funeral at the last minute during an anguishing time of your life is an unnecessary personal burden. Thompson Miller Funeral Home in Butler suggests that you pre-plan the funeral. Make all the choices now while you're still emotionally stable. The funeral service, the choice of caskets, which minister, priest, or rabbi, cremation, visitations, flowers, church service or not, all of these decisions must be made. Make them now before the emotions set in. Pre-plan with Thompson Miller. Think about it, then call us to meet with you and to discuss it privately. Call 724-287-3706, 287-3706. Pre-arrangement. It really makes sense. Thompson Miller Funeral Home at the corner of East North and McCain Streets in downtown Butler. Thompson Miller, time-honored excellence.
On May 21st, there's a very important election for a new judge in the Butler County Court of Common Pleas. This is Attorney Wink Robinson. If elected as judge, I pledge that I will perform my duties impartially, with competency, and independent from outside influences. The dignity of the court will be maintained. Your confidence will never be a cause for concern. I have 30 years of courtroom experience with the patience and legal skills to apply the law in a fair yet firm manner. Please elect me to be your next judge on Tuesday, May 21st. Paid for by William Wink Robinson.
We are discussing with Laurie Hinderlander the book Where the Crawdads Sing by Delia Owens. Runaway bestseller for the past several months, still on the New York Times bestseller list. The loneliness that this young girl experienced, and a couple of moments that were particularly poignant, I thought. She's planting a garden. I don't know, Mabel or Jumpin' or somebody gave her some seeds. And her mother's garden was all overgrown, and she starts hoeing it and, you know, try to plant some seeds. And she finds one of her mother's barrettes.
Yes.
That was, you know, in the dirt, and she puts it in her hair. The only memory she has of her mother. And at one point, her father gave her his old World War II canvas knapsack to put her feathers and her shells in. And it was the only thing that her father ever gave her in her entire life. No birthday presents, no nothing.
She wasn't even sure when her birthday actually was.
It's true, I forgot about that, yeah.
So those items, a couple other things she found of her mother's or she knew that she had, but very few.
So a lonely life. So Tate, the puppy love romantic interest, heads off to study nature and become a scientist. She's still there in the marsh. And then she... But this was disappointing to me.
She hooks up
with this Chase guy. What the heck is she thinking?
I don't know. I just, when they started introducing this part of the storyline, I was just like, please don't go there.
No, I'm thinking it's like when you're watching a horror movie on TV and the lady decides she's going to go into the house where you know the ghost is and you're screaming, don't go in there.
Exactly.
Don't go there.
Exactly. But she did. I think partly because she just was so lonely and... even though Chase was, let's admit it, a real jerk, he showed some interest to her for whatever his intentions were, you know.
Showed interest in a lot of the women around the village.
True. Yeah. And so they formed some type of relationship.
And she actually thinks he's going to marry her.
Well, he tells her this. He tells her all kinds of things. Of course, it's all hush-hush, secret. No one outside of, you know, the marsh really knows anything about their relationship.
Mm-hmm. Which should make you a little doubtful from the very beginning.
Exactly. And time goes on and she, you know, waits for him and he basically disappears again. And she must have gotten a copy of the newspaper at Jumpin's. Is that where that happened, I think? Maybe?
I know that she saw in the newspaper that he was engaged to somebody else.
Yes.
And of course.
And it happened to be one of the young ladies that all through the years had been part of this group that always made fun of her.
Mm-hmm. So she was devastated.
Devastated. But as time went on, she kind of resigned herself that she would be alone by herself. And that she would just take solace in her environment and the animals and that she had created relationships for.
So we keep cutting back and forth, and I don't want you to think this is confusing. It really isn't, but we keep going back to the murder investigation when the body of Chase Andrews is found at the bottom of the fire tower, the fire watchtower. And... The sheriff and his deputy do find some evidence. They do some lab work. They kept talking about getting fingerprints off the fire tower and the trap door. And I'm thinking, what? Wouldn't be any fingerprints, would there?
Back in that day, I don't know exactly what their methods or, you know, what the technique would be. But at the same token, there were a lot of clues missing. Everything looked exactly like it were, almost like someone had come in and erased everything. Mm-hmm. It was too neat.
They did, however, in one of their lab reports, come up with some red fibers.
Yes, they suggested like a wool hat or some piece of clothing.
Mm-hmm.
But that was about the only significant, scientifically proven.
So they thought they would vacillate back and forth when they thought it was an accident that he somehow fell down. But then how did the trap door get shut if he fell through the trap door? You know, who shut it? And then so maybe it was murder because of...
who he was.
Yeah, he wasn't liked around town, especially by some of the guys. Mm-hmm. And so they just weren't sure.
Yes.
Yeah. But eventually... I think partly because of the prejudice against the marsh girl, Kia, people started thinking that it was her.
It could be her, particularly Chase's mother came to the police at some point in time and said that she had an idea who it was because she had discovered their relationship, Chase and Kia's relationship at some point in time, and of course she was very prejudiced against her and was just appalled that he would even have anything to do with her. So that also helped steer everyone's thoughts to the marsh girl.
Mm-hmm. So eventually she's actually arrested, right?
Yes, it took some time. Like I said, it reminded me of Andy Griffith, but they they did that.
Well, Barney.
But they did actually then, well, they had to find her first because she was very good at evading any,
Yeah, when human. People, she learned that when she was young, when the truant officer would come looking for her, she would go hide in the marsh.
Very much, you know, she'd learned tricks from the wild animals that evaded, you know, eluded the humans. So she picked up on some of those things and some of the things that her brother had taught her. And so when they finally did, I would say they almost tricked her because they caught her at jump-ins. And, you know, I mean, it was, so she was arrested. And they kept her in jail while they were awaiting trial. And, of course, there again is another instance of isolation. Mm-hmm. And the one friend that she made there was the cat, the jail cat.
Yeah. So there is a trial.
Yes.
This is the courtroom part that we were talking about in the beginning.
Very much a courtroom drama.
And the red fibers come into play
as
evidence because she had a, what was it? Red hat, was it?
Red hat.
Yeah.
Yes.
But eventually, she's acquitted.
Yes. Eventually.
Not enough evidence.
No, and they released her, and she, her brother had been at the trial for part of the time. Kate had come back, was now through college. And so
yes,
she had,
let's talk about that a little bit because he comes back. This is young Tate.
Yes.
And he says, gosh, I'm sorry that I abandoned you, and here I am back. And so, you know, let's be a couple. And she says, well, I'm engaged to somebody else. She thought she was engaged to Chase. So,
and she wasn't real happy about the way he had left things.
Yeah.
No matter what would happen with Chase. So.
Yeah. So, but there's a part in here, too, where, and this was another thing, I don't know why she put it in there, because it seemed unbelievable to me. She writes a book.
Oh, yes.
And
yes,
when Tate gets published.
Yes, when Tate comes back from his college days, and he now has a job that works, his work is in the marsh, he encouraged her to have a book published. She had been keeping, I'll say, journals and drawings of all these feather collections and different things, shells that she had. So, long story short, she had a book published of the shells, and actually several books published, even though she was stayed isolated and never really left the marsh. She was able to have all of these things published, and then that became a source of income, and she became rich, maybe? I don't know. But much more secure financially.
I kind of rolled my eyeballs at that part. Here was somebody who was illiterate until she was in her mid-teens, and some older boy taught her to read, and she ends up publishing all these books. I didn't see that.
Perhaps that was just a reference to some of our author's own experiences getting into the nonfiction field.
Well, and Delia Owens, the author of Where the Crawdads Sing, as you mentioned earlier, a very distinguished nature writer, spent years living in Africa with her husband studying animals, so I suppose it was, let's sneak a little bit of autobiographical stuff in here for Kia. It just didn't, I don't know, it just didn't read
it,
to me.
It was a pretty far-fetched concept, especially more than one, you know.
A lot of analogies in here, though, from nature to human behavior. Part of the way Kia thought that men would act, young men or older men, was what she had seen in nature.
Correct.
Do you remember the one scene where the wild turkeys killed another wild turkey?
Yes.
Because it had been, what was it, it become injured or something,
and
they pecked it to death.
Yes, exactly.
And she watched this. And
they weren't accepting anyone who was inferior.
Yeah.
So, again, that whole bullying, prejudice type of theme in there as well.
So they were going back and forth from nature to humans, to humans, yeah. Mm-hmm. I was struck by some of the wonderful language that Delia Owens used, especially for a first-time novelist.
Yes.
I marked one other thing. Don't want to bore you with quotes here, but this is a very short one. This is when the sheriff and his deputy, I think it's Ed and Joe, I think. I'm not sure. I can't remember the names, but they're stumped. You know, they're not, is this Chase Adams, was he murdered? Was it an accident? And listen to these couple of sentences. The sheriff pulled a bottle from the bottom drawer of his desk and poured them both a double in coffee mugs. They sipped until the sun, as golden and syrupy as the bourbon, slipped into the sea. That's yes. really good language.
Yes. Well, and also we haven't mentioned that throughout the book, there was a lot of poetry that's referred to, and a poet that you had never heard of, and it actually ended up being Kaya, but there's a lot of language that is wonderful in the book.
Mm-hmm. Where the Crawdads Sing. Are we going to tell you the ending of the book? No.
No.
We're not going to do it.
We can't even get, we're not even going to, no. Go.
We're not even going to hint. Hints, no. Well, I don't know. For big money, we might tell you.
We will just say that the acquittal and a courtroom drama, the ending of that was not the end of the story.
Mm-hmm. And it's not the end for young Tate Walker either.
No.
You know. After all, Chase is dead now, so the door is open again, you know.
Yeah. Correct.
But it does have, like, kind of, I don't know, kind of an epilogue, I guess you would say.
Yes.
Where the pieces are all tied together, which I like in a novel. You know?
I like that.
Let's wrap up the loose ends.
It was a great way to wrap it up and to end the book. You weren't disappointed. You didn't feel that you had been deprived of something.
Agatha Christie would sometimes have a surprise ending. Mm-hmm. Pretty surprise ending in this one, too,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Does Ma come back? Does Pa come back? We're not telling you. And you're probably not going to be able to get a copy at your library for several months either because of such a long waiting list. Hey, I enjoyed this book. It's not the best book I've read in my life, but it was a very enjoyable read.
I thought it was a great read. It'd be a great summer read if you can get a hold of it.
Perfect.
And easy read. Mm-hmm. Easy read.
Yeah. And not a whole lot of big words, although I had to look up what a palmetto was. Did you know?
I had an idea. But
I should have known from the name. It's a little palm, of course, palmetto. Grow low to the ground. But she used to hang her laundry on them. That's what confused me. I'm thinking, how the heck is she hanging laundry on a palm tree? You know, you need a ladder to get up mm-hmm. there. But they're very low. Palms are apparently quite common in the Carolinas.
Apparently so.
Yeah. Well, you learn a little bit about nature. Yeah. As we said at the beginning, this is part coming-of-age novel. It's part murder mystery. It's part courtroom drama. It's not bad. It's pretty good stuff.
It's one of the better ones I have read in quite a while.
Well, it was a good pick, Lori.
Thank you.
It was a good pick. Hey, coming up next month, we already know the book that we're going to read, and I can't wait to get started on this one. The First Conspiracy. Mm-hmm. It's a little history by Brad Meltzer. I've read a couple of his books before. So we'll be talking about that on Book Talk in June. June 24th will be the date. Boy, that sounds like a long ways off, doesn't it?
I don't know. I think it's going to be here quicker than you think.
Well, a week from today's Memorial Day, and you know, June is right after that. Lori Hinderleiter is the executive director of the Butler Area Public Library. Thanks for being here today. Thanks for picking this book.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
I will put this copy in your precious care.
Thank you.
Guard it.
I will.
There'll be people waiting for that.
When I take it back to the library, I'm sure it will be off to somewhere else.
Lori, good to see you again.
Great to see you.
Enjoy the rest of your day, folks, and hope to see you tomorrow for the Tuesday edition of It's Your Turn at 12:30 here on WISR.
Thanks for joining us for today's edition of It's Your Turn with Dave Malarkey here on WISR 680 AM. To Today's broadcast is also archived for you online at WISR680.com. Tune in again next time for Dave Malarkey's It's Your Turn, weekdays from 12:30 to 1:30, right here on WISR 680.
And the endless sky.